Many of the assessments of Benedict's legacy have focused on his orthodox positions on issues such as women priests, same-sex marriage, contraception, and abortion, where it's been no to all. But does this really get to the heart of Benedict's theology? Our next guest thinks that he's been a more radical figure in this way. Unlike many predecessors, he hasn't been preoccupied by the thinking of Thomas Aquinas. Now, in short, Aquinas was all about the need for rules and propositions to know God, and this so-called Thomism was used to codify Catholic teaching and sometimes to limit change. But Jean Bethke-Elstein says that even though Benedict appears to be a stickler for the rules, he's actually gone back to St. Augustine, who was all about love and sinfulness, by the way. Augustine argued that people could know and experience God because they're capable of love, and this spilled over into the Pope's thinking about people's obligation to each other before self-interest. In fact, Benedict's first encyclical was called God is Love. Dr. Elstein often appears on lists of America's foremost public intellectuals. She's the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Professor of Social and Political Ethics at the Divinity School at the University of Chicago. She's written dozens of books, including Augustine and The Limits of Politics. She converted from Lutheranism to Catholicism, by the way, during the papacy of Benedict. I spoke to her earlier today.
It strikes me that he would certainly be forward-looking in the sense that he really opened up in Germany a dialogue between Catholicism and Lutheranism. And he helped to shift the sort of grounding of Catholic thought somewhat away from Thomism, St. Thomas Aquinas, and brought in explicitly more of the Augustinian strain. And he's done that by bringing more Augustine in. So for those of us who are Augustinians, this was very exciting to see. And it's important to remember about Pope Benedict that he believed that Christianity in general has been lost to a great extent in Western Europe, and that a new period of evangelization is necessary. And his ability to reach out to other faith communities was terribly important. You could just look at his very, very successful pilgrimage to the UK, to England, and how he was received there.
Yes, but Professor Elstein, I think if we were to look more honestly, there were some stumbles along the way. I mean, very early on in his papacy, he made a speech at Regensburg University that upset many in the Islamic community. Probably not the most politically clever thing to do, given that there are 44 million Muslims in Europe. And then he did put some members of the Jewish community offside with a decision to bring back into the church an English archbishop who had denied details of the Holocaust. So there were stumbles, weren't there?
Yes, and I think you identified the reason. He really isn't a very political person at all. Otherwise, he would have, I think, caught that one or two sentences in his Regensburg lecture, which was really an academic lecture. He would have caught that and said, wait a minute, this isn't going to be read as an academic lecture. This is going to be read as words from the Pope and have an importance that just a lecture by a philosopher would not. I think he was stunned by the controversy that ensued, because the whole basis of the Regensburg Address is a critique of the West, really. And it's an argument in favor of the notion that we can come to know God in large part through reason, not fully and completely, and we have to get away from a more willful notion of the deity. In theology, it's voluntarist ideal of the papacy and of God. And that he repudiates, that he rejects. So, you know, you could lift that sentence or two out of the Regensburg Address and not really lose much of anything. But he wanted to illustrate the point that religion can lead directly to violence if one is stressing God as a kind of omnipotent quasi-tyrant, I suppose. So that was unfortunate, but it did lead to some authentic dialogue and a robust dialogue ensued. You know, the controversy of the moment was unfortunate in many ways. The dialogue that followed that was vital and quite important.
You also mentioned, Professor, that you thought he was a forward-looking pope. The break, perhaps, on that outlook, though, was some of the, one would describe them more as restorations rather than reforms, in the sense that he wanted to restore tradition to the liturgy, things that have certain, yes. They certainly have their own beauty, but at the same time they were considered to alienate a new generation of Catholics. It was seen to be looking backwards.
That's a tough call, don't you think? Because often looking backwards is a way that we look forward. That is to say, we look to the past, to the resources of the past, or we can, and find in the past rich material that's been allowed to languish or repress them. So oftentimes the way to move forward is through going back to the sources, and that's really what he represents, that notion that you have to open the window to new things, absolutely. But at the same time, you can't do only that. You also have to return to the sources and make sure that you ground yourself in hard-won truths and you find new ways to defend them, perhaps, or new challenges to some of the standard thinking, not just in pressure from the external world, so to speak, today, but in what many Christian thinkers and theologians, pastors and priests have said or done in the past. I wouldn't say that looking to history is necessarily, you know, a reactionary move.
Just finally, Professor, one of his principal documents that he released during his papacy was his encyclical, Caritas in Veritate. This was described in America magazine as perhaps the most radical papal encyclical since John the 23rd issued his encyclical 50 years ago. This was really a challenge to our whole economic order, wasn't
it? Yes, indeed. And in fact, Catholic social thought has been a challenge to our economic order for decades. People just haven't paid too much attention.
What were the principal precepts of Caritas in Veritate, Pope Benedict's encyclical?
And the underlying view is what we would call the anthropological one. You know, what kind of a creature is a human being? And for Pope Benedict and his predecessor and so on, we are innately social beings. We're born in communio. We have obligations to one another. We must offer ourselves to one another. And it is an Augustinian moment, if you will, because Augustine, as you know, emphasizes love in all of his writing, that we are best understood by looking at what it is that we cherish and that we love. And in that lies the truth of the human person. It was very startling to have it put in such cogent terms and spelled out in the way that he did. And I think drew people's attention to those aspects of church teaching that are not paid attention to, not covered, you know, by the media and so forth.
And not something I think that would have been welcomed on Wall Street or any of the financial markets.
Oh no, of course not. Of course not. It's important to remember that even as the 20th century Pope criticized tyrannical systems, totalitarian systems, command economies, they also criticized unbridled free market economies. So how do you preserve a free market of a sort that's vital to human freedom and human flourishing, but you do it in a way that does not destroy communities? And I think that's something that is not very well understood, you know, as a major aspect of Catholic social teaching.
Well, Professor Jean Bethke Elstein, a philosopher, a member of the faculty at the Divinity School at the University of Chicago, author and commentator, we're grateful for your time. Thank you for being on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you very much for inviting me.